The Presidencies of the United States is a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network.
I sincerely hope that I may be ordered by General Flannoy and the Whom I Act to penetrate into the Creek Nation. More could be effected now by 1,000 men than could be accomplished 3 months hence by double that number. If I am ordered to act on the defensive, much serious injury will be done on the frontiers. The best mode of fighting Indians is to penetrate into the heart of their settlements and to give them battle at the threshold of their doors. General Ferdinand Claiborne to Georgia Governor David B. Mitchell, 14th of August, 1813.
Way back in episode 4.19, we talked about the Muskogee attacks in mid-1812 on white settlers in Tennessee and the Mississippi Territory. There would be punishments taken out on some of the alleged instigators of these attacks, but still, they would carry on into the new year, and these attacks would have grave ramifications for the future of the native peoples of the Gulf South. Before we get to that, though, I'd like to welcome you to the Presidencies of the United States. I'm your host, Jerry Landry. Special thanks to Jackson Van Uden for providing the intro quote for this episode. Jackson is the host of History with Jackson, a history podcast begun in 2021 with an aim to bring fascinating topics from the annals of history to the general populace. Recent topics covered on his podcast range from the history of the Roman Empire from the viewpoint of women, the impact of the Mongols on the Near East during the medieval period, and even some presidential history with an episode on how Bill Clinton utilized baseball as part of his public relations strategy during his presidency. With a wide variety of topics, I'm sure you'll find plenty of episodes that suit your historical interest, and you'll likely learn about some eras or figures in history with whom you were previously unfamiliar. This episode is coming out around the time that Jackson is celebrating the third anniversary of launching his podcast. So congratulations to Jackson, and here's to many more years of podcasting ahead. Check out the History with Jackson podcast by going to his website, which is historywithjackson.co.uk, or search for History with Jackson wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, podcast listeners, I'm Paul Brandis introducing my podcast, Countdown to Dallas. It's a fascinating, in-depth look at the seemingly unconnected events that led to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's based on my book of the same title. In that book and in this podcast, I go all the way back to 1939, when Lee Harvey Oswald was born into a troubled and dysfunctional family. I'll follow his transient and often violent teenage years and young adulthood, painting a fuller picture of the man who would later become Kennedy's killer. I also take a look at events unfolding in that era, like Cuba and Vietnam, and I'll unpack the conspiracy theories too, not one of which has ever been conclusively proven. Subscribe to Countdown to Dallas at evergreenpodcasts.com or your favorite listening app, October 31st.
In February 1813, a coalition of warriors from nations in the Old Northwest and Muskogee tribes from the Southwest joined together to attack a group of white settlers, quote, at the mouth of the Ohio River, and seven families would lose their lives in this assault. Every new attack meant that pressure was increased on white officials in the area to respond, but Indian agents such as Benjamin Hawkins were reluctant to break the connections with the native peoples that they had built and that had proven so beneficial over the years. Tensions did not just involve native peoples in the area, however. The American seizure of Mobile, as discussed last episode, meant that the Spanish in what remained of Florida were also on edge. As noted by historian Frank Lawrence Owsley Jr., quote, the communications among the various Spanish commanders at the time of the seizure of Mobile indicated a high degree of frustration and anger. A delicate balance had been maintained for decades, where the Spanish ensured that the native forces were strong enough to defend themselves against white encroachment, but not enough to go on the offensive against the Americans. Just like the U.S. Indian agents in the area, the Spanish would not benefit from a full-scale war breaking out. However, the Spanish were not the only European power exerting influence in the area, and at the time, due to the Napoleonic takeover of Spain and the Spanish-American revolutions across the Western Hemisphere, as we've discussed in recent episodes, they were far from the strongest. The British had good motivation to exert themselves, and unlike the Spanish, they had reason to want to push the native peoples of the Southwest to war against the U.S. Though technically the British did not have a colony in that part of North America, given its location on the Gulf Coast, the British would route trade with the native nations of the area from Nassau in the Bahamas and sometimes from Jamaica through the area around the mouth of the Apalachicola River. As noted by Owsley, quote, "Much of the British trade with the Indians was illegal, according to the Spanish, and they wished to stop it or to regulate it." The Spanish had built a fort in the area in an attempt to block the British trade, but, quote, "the fort was weak and largely ineffective." Thus, the British were able to continue to supply the native forces and prod them into open hostilities with the Americans in order to take some of the pressure off of the Canadian front of the War of 1812. The fact that the Spanish were suffering from a lack of supplies from their own forces defending the Floridas from the Americans meant that they had little to trade and limited their ability to influence, though some native forces believed that the Spanish, like the British, were committed to supplying them in efforts against the Americans. Unfortunately, a summons from the Spanish governor of West Florida, Mauricio Zuniga, for native forces to come to Pensacola reinforced this mistaken belief. Zuniga, rather than wanting to support native military efforts, was hoping, as were other Spanish colonial officials, that they could enlist native support for the defense of the Floridas, something that was seen as crucial to what would otherwise be a lost cause. Before the first native forces arrived at Pensacola in May 1813, however, there had been a change of leadership in the colony's capital. By that point, Zuniga had been replaced by Don Mateo González Manrique. Governor González Manrique abandoned his predecessor's policy and, when native forces arrived, quote, he sent them away without giving them arms. González Manrique was hoping that, rather than relying on the support of native nations, he could procure reinforcements and supplies from Cuba. As Owsley notes, however, quote, the second and larger group of Creeks arrived, demanding arms before he, i.e., González Manrique, had received any new supplies or any approval of his plans. Though the governor was unwilling to give them arms, he sought to appease them by offering a sizable amount of other supplies. However, there was a bit of a standoff and some tense moments as the native warriors were not happy with what they saw as a betrayal of their understanding, and they would not leave until they managed to convince both González Manrique and merchants in Pensacola to arm them. Ultimately, when González Manrique shared his reluctance with his superiors in Havana to supply the native peoples with war materials, he would find himself out of step as he received orders back to without question arm any future native forces that came to Pensacola and to urge them to fight the Americans rather than putting Spanish troops on the front lines. As we have seen multiple times during the Madison Presidency series, events in the field would often go in their own direction before news could travel to and instructions be received from leaders in distant capitals. By the time the Second Native Party left Pensacola with their arms, word had already been received by the senior American officer in the area, Colonel James Collar, of their aims and intentions. Collar knew that the native delegation had to be intercepted and the weapons and powder confiscated before they could be distributed to war parties. Thus, he mobilized his force of around 180 men and started the search. On the morning of July 27, 1813, their efforts proved fruitful as a scout spotted the native party near a bend of Burnt Corn Creek, which is in modern-day southern Alabama, close to what's now the border of the Florida Panhandle. Collar positioned his forces in three sections, quote, on a slight rise overlooking the peninsula, and ordered an immediate charge. Despite the element of surprise, the Muskogee force that had been engaged, which was only a fraction of the larger native party, regrouped and retreated across the creek and, quote, took refuge in a swamp which had much tall grass and other growth. From this cover, they opened fire on the white men and were able to inflict some wounds. Upon hearing gunfire, the the main part of the native force sprung to action, and Collar's troops were shortly facing between 60 to 100 native warriors. Even worse than the fact that they were facing a larger force was that Collar's force had initially thought the battle was over and had turned their attention to the pack horses carrying the powder and supplies that had been obtained from Pensacola. As the shots coming from the swamp became more intense, the Americans' returning fire could not match. And before long, the native force emerged in a charge on Collar's men, who turned to retreat and scattered into the wilderness. Part of the American militia was able to regroup on the high ground, but they found themselves to be less than half of the original troop assembled. Indeed, Colonel Collar himself was lost in the woods for days before he finally made his way home. Though the estimated casualty figures are low for both sides, this engagement, which would come to be known as the Battle of Burnt Corn Creek, or just simply the Battle of Burnt Corn, would come to be the opening battle of a conflict that would be dubbed the Creek War. Again from Owsley, quote, "Although the losses were small, this skirmish resulted in a significant victory for the Indians. Burnt Corn was, after all, an unusual defeat. Heretofore, whenever the whites had a force which was approximately equal to the Indians, the whites had won. When the victorious Indians reached the hostile camps, they showed the scalps they had taken and claimed to have routed completely an enormous American army. This victory, they maintained, proved that they had supernatural power and could not be defeated." As the hostile Muskogee forces prepped to push the fight to the whites, American settlers in the Mississippi Territory began to prepare for their defense, with most of the militia forces in the area called into active service and with civilians being moved into the scattered forts in the area. Brigadier General Ferdinand L. Claiborne, the commander of the militia, decided, quote, "to divide his troops into detachments and send them to reinforce the various forts." This decision, however, meant that he had no troops on hand that could be used to launch an offensive operation against their native opponents. Claiborne sent a request to the commander of the U.S. Army's 7th Military District, General Thomas Flournoy, for support, but Flournoy, like Claiborne, had no troops to spare. Meanwhile, they didn't know until it was too late that the hostile native forces were looking at a couple of the forts which had been established as defensive measures as potential targets for a full-scale assault. Fort Pierce was 2 miles southeast of what would come to be the objective that was ultimately selected for an attack, Fort Mims. This fort had been hastily constructed on the plantation of Samuel Mims, described by historian Howard T. Ware III as, quote, "an old and wealthy Indian countryman who had settled in the region at the end of the last century." Ware describes the landscape as being, quote, "on a slight rise about 1/4 mile upland from a body of water known as Tensaw Lake or the Tensaw Boatyard in modern-day southern Alabama. The fort was built around the plantation's buildings as, quote, "the local residents of all ages and races, black, white, mixed blood, and Indian, flocked to Mims Plantation from their outlying farms during the month of July." Again from Ware, quote, "in the steamy heat of early August 1813, the area around Mims Plantation houses must have resembled an enormous country fair run amok. And as the month drew near to its close, there were around 275 to 300 individuals in residence there. The fact that some of the people taking refuge at this fort were mixed blood and Muskogee friendly with the Americans made it an even more attractive target to the hostile native forces, who by this point were being referred to as the Red Sticks due to the war clubs they carried. By late August, they were in position with a force of around 750 warriors and had scouted out the defenses without the Americans being aware. Though a Choctaw had spied the native warriors at one point, the scouts sent out by the defenders of Fort Mims had no clue just how close their would-be attackers were, despite getting rather close to the Red Stick forces on their scouting missions. Early on August 30th, two enslaved young black boys reported seeing, quote, "a great number of Indians painted, running, and hallooing, but after a cursory search in the area found nothing, the two, quote, were whipped for giving a false alarm when the scouts failed to see anything of a suspicious nature." Owsley rightly criticizes the leadership for being lax in the fort's defense, leading to what was to come later that day. Around noon, the Red Stick forces attacked Fort Mims, and before the gate could be closed, the Native forces led by a half-white, half-Muskogee leader named William Weatherford were in the fort. The fort's commander died in the first assault, and those remaining, quote, took refuge in or behind the buildings of the fort where the various officers made their defense. Coordinating a defense, however, was not easy, as most of the fort was open space and Native warriors were stationed at the portholes along the outer wall, ready to fire at anyone venturing into the open. The circumstances of the fort thus made communication between the various defenders difficult. There was certainly an opportunity to push back, as the Native forces by 3 p.m., quote, were ready to withdraw. But instead, the Red Sticks opted to start setting fire to the buildings. Thus, the places of shelter for those taking refuge in the fort were turned into death traps, and the remaining defenders had to take the risk to consolidate into other buildings. Finally, they were down to two buildings, which were not large enough to hold everyone. They were able to inflict heavy losses on Weatherford's troops as they launched numerous assaults on the buildings, but it was not enough. The few remaining survivors risked going out into the open and, quote, ran into the swamp or woods and fled from the Indians. As noted by Owsley, quote, the number who thus survived the Fort Mims massacre has never been determined. A few women and a large number of blacks were carried off by the Indians, but most of them were eventually freed. Most, however, had met a grisly fate as, quote, many of the settlers were burned alive inside the buildings where they were trapped. Others were dispatched quite brutally by the Native forces, despite Weatherford's supposed urging for leniency. Out of the estimated 275 to 300 people at Fort Mims at the beginning of the assault, quote, around 250 to 275 were killed in the battle or carried off as prisoner. Though it's difficult to determine an accurate figure, the Natives suffered great losses at Fort Mims as well, at least 100 to 150 dead and many more injured, some of whom would die of their wounds later. Further, they gained few weapons and munitions from the assault and instead wasted, quote, precious ammunition and irreplaceable manpower. The news of Fort Mims spread like wildfire across the nation, but as it spread, before an official inquiry and report were made, rumors and exaggeration abounded. The purported number of casualties ballooned to around 400 to 600 individuals, and one can only imagine what terrors were conceived by panicked imaginations. Further, as a sign of the inherent prejudicial views of the time, there were some who couldn't believe that a Native man could have led a force to victory. They argued that the Native warriors must have been led by either a British or a Spanish officer. Some American officials, particularly Governor Claiborne in Louisiana, feared that enslaved individuals would join forces with the Native warriors and launch coordinated assaults. Expressing this fear to General Flournoy, the general wrote back to Claiborne, giving him a directive, quote, to exterminate any slaves found with the Red Clubs. Now, to be fair, even without the hyperbolic overreaction and just taking into consideration the reality of the situation, for folks on the frontier, it is understandable that they would be fearful. As noted by Owsley, quote, no fort of this size and strength had ever been captured by the Indians. Thus, it's understandable that there was an immediate push for settlers to evacuate the area and that before long, the area was, quote, effectively emptied of most of the remaining settlers. However, as noted by historian Howard Weir, quote, in terms of strategic value, the attack was a colossal blunder. Although the Red Club attack virtually rid the entire region of its remaining settlers, it also provided the excuse the Americans had been waiting for to send their massing armies into the nation to dispossess the Muskogee people, friend as well as foe, of their enviable lands. One of the leaders in that push would of course be someone who we're going to get to know quite well over time, Andrew Jackson of Tennessee. As we saw when we last encountered him back in episode 4.19, Jackson had been advocating since the spring of 1812 to take offensive action against Native forces in the Southwest, and in his capacity as Major General of the Tennessee State Militia, during the course of 1813, he had appealed directly to Governor Wiley Blount to send Tennessee volunteer troops into the Muskogee lands. Jackson's reputation had taken a hit over the years due to his ill temperament and proclivity to settle affairs of honor with a duel. But with the outbreak of the war and his strong advocacy for the defense of the frontier, as well as his support of the volunteer troops of the state, he was seeing a resurgence of popularity. A few days after Fort Mims, however, before the news had even reached the city, Nashville, Tennessee witnessed, on September 4, 1813, a shootout and knockdown brawl between Jackson, accompanied by his nephew and Jackson's friend John Coffey, and Thomas Hart Benton and his brother Jesse over a personal dispute in which Jesse was involved. Jackson was seriously injured in the skirmish, and, as his biographer Robert Remini noted, quote, "This was the last of Jackson's great gunfights. Like the others, there was something petty about it. None of Jackson's quarrels did him credit. All diminished him. This one, however, threatened to take him from the field of battle at a critical point. He was still very weak when he heard the news of Fort Mims. A shattered shoulder and a metal ball from a pistol lodged in his arm, however, would not keep Jackson from missing out on, quote, his long-awaited opportunity for military glory. He must begin a campaign at once, even if he had to drag himself from bed and tie himself to his horse. Though he had no official authorization at this point, Jackson sent orders to the militia, quote, to rendezvous at Fayetteville for immediate duty against the Creeks, assuring them that, quote, the health of your general is restored. He will command in person. Ultimately, in a coordinated effort between the federal government and the state governments of Georgia and Tennessee, as well as the territorial government of Mississippi, a plan was devised. Four armies would be assembled. Jackson's in West Tennessee, along with another from East Tennessee that would connect in northern Alabama and proceed into the Muskogee Nation, while another militia army from Georgia marched west, and the 3rd U.S. Army Regiment, augmented by militia forces from the Mississippi Territory, would head east. Overall command was given to Major General Thomas Pinckney of South Carolina, who was in command of the 6th Military District. For astute listeners, yes, this is the same Thomas Pinckney who served as U.S. Minister to Britain and negotiated Pinckney's treaty with Spain during the Washington administration, and who also served as the Federalist candidate for Vice President in 1796, all discussed in the Washington Presidency series. Pinckney was not President Madison's first choice, however. Initially, he thought of offering the command to Georgia Governor David Bridie Mitchell, the same governor who had been in command of U.S. forces during the Patriot War, as discussed in episodes 4.21 and 4.26. However, this command was conditional on Mitchell remaining as governor, and for whatever reason, Mitchell decided to resign as governor. Thus, as noted by Weir, Madison was able to appoint, quote, a real military man to the command. The appointment of Pinckney to command this force, however, created some tension as the Muskogee Nation's lands primarily fell in what had been designated the 7th Military District, which was commanded by Brigadier General Thomas Flournoy, who was discussed earlier in this episode. To be fair, there were good reasons for choosing Pinckney over Flournoy. Flournoy had come to his initial command in June 1812, quote, without any prior military experience, which was fine so long as his command's responsibilities were primarily to monitor, quote, the border with Spanish East Florida, where at the time there was little expectation of trouble. However, now that there was a full-scale military operation in the works, a 38-year-old lawyer from Georgia was probably not the best choice to command four armies versus a 63-year-old general who had fought in the Revolutionary War and had served under General Lafayette. As described by Weir, quote, beneath his seductive wealth and glittering personal accomplishments, Pinckney was a decent, fair-minded man without hatred of the Indians or any desire to enhance his career over the bodies of those people. Moreover, as he was soon to demonstrate, Pinckney possessed a degree of military acumen and organizational skills that the younger commanders under him lacked. Thus, Flournoy was assured command of his military district, except in any matters related to military operations against the Muskogee. Nothing could go wrong with that, right? Right? The overall strategy was a solid one. As described by Owsley, quote, all units were to attack any red sticks they encountered on the way, burn all hostile or abandoned villages, and destroy the crops. Each army was also expected to build and garrison forts about one day's march apart so that when the central point was reached, there would be a line of blockhouses dividing the Creek country north and south, east and west. The advancing armies would build roads between the stockades not already connected by navigable waterways, and each installation would be provided a stockpile of supplies, enabling large armies to move into them rapidly. The central point that the forces would converge was, quote, where the Coosa and Tallapoosa rivers flow together to form the Alabama River, near the present town of Wetumpka, Alabama. It was a sound plan. However, it would take time for the details of that plan and the command structure to reach key commanders like Flournoy and Jackson, who were already making their own plans. To the south, Flournoy had authorized an expedition led by the commander of the Mississippi Territorial Militia, General Ferdinand Cleburne. This expedition would derisively be referred to as the Potato Expedition, quote, because that tuber was almost the only thing they had to eat and the only thing they captured while chasing their will-o'-the-wisp opponents. Cleburne attributed his problems with the campaign to Flournoy. As noted by Ware, quote, Cleburne rightly saw that the best way to quickly defeat the hostile Creeks was to strike them in their population centers. Flournoy, with his wider responsibilities, was more concerned with meeting an attack by the British on the Gulf Coast than with chasing savages through the wilderness. To give Flournoy some credit here, this idea of a British attack on the southern coast wasn't as much of a far-fetched possibility as it had been at the beginning of the war. Still, his time was nearly up, and on November 6th, Flournoy received his orders to turn over the 3rd Regiment to the command of General Cleburne and learned of Pinckney's appointment as overall commander. Thus, Flournoy took the troops under his command and returned in a huff to his base in New Orleans, leaving Cleburne to continue operations with what troops remained after Flournoy's withdrawal and his dismissal of the Mississippi Dragoons, a militia force that Flournoy had pronounced to, quote, lack discipline, though Cleburne had expressed his favorable opinion of them. There were two key battles to come out of Cleburne's campaign in the latter days of 1813, the first of which has come to be known as the Canoe Fight, which, as it sounds, was a fight between American forces in canoes versus Native forces in a canoe. As noted by Owsley, quote, the skirmish was significant in that it was won by force and cunning rather than by an advantage in firearms on the part of the whites. They administered this defeat to the Indians by using gun butts and boat paddles as clubs. Yeah, this one was never going down as another Battle of Saratoga or Guilford Courthouse. It did, however, have an impact on the Native forces. As noted by Weir, quote, after several terrifying months of being on the defensive and months of being frustrated by Weatherford's tactics, the Americans had finally scored, however meager, a morale-boosting victory against that seemingly unbeatable Indian leader. The larger victory would come when Cleburne's force marched on William Weatherford's home base, a town called Holy Ground, on December 23, 1813. Its inhabitants believed, quote, that the ground had been consecrated especially for the Indians, and that it was surrounded by an invisible barrier which would strike dead any white man who tried to pass through it. Unfortunately for the native peoples, this did not prove to be the case, and thus the defense of the town rested on the shoulders of Weatherford and about 30 warriors. As described by Owsley, quote, the village on the holy ground was fortified with stakes and fallen logs and located on high ground surrounded by wooded ravines. If some of the folks in the town had not fled when the invisible barrier failed, it is possible that their additional strength could have helped repel the American force. Ultimately, around, quote, 33 red sticks were killed, 12 of whom were black men, quote, fighting as allies of the Creeks. The American troops only sustained one fatality and 20 wounded. Weatherford fought for as long as he could, but ultimately withdrew. As noted by Owsley, quote, "Even though most of the Indians escaped, the Battle of Holy Ground reduced their strength and proved conclusively that they were not invincible. Moreover, it allowed Claiborne the opportunity to build a series of forts along the Alabama River, which would form a key section of the overall plan to divide and conquer the Muskogee Nation." Again from Owsley, quote, "The best invasion route into the Creek Nation was by way of the Alabama River. Had there been a substantial army in this sector, the Indians might have been defeated quickly." That was not to be, however. After the victory at the Battle of Holy Ground, Claiborne ordered his troops back to Fort Claiborne and discharged the militia forces under his command as, quote, "their terms of service had expired." As Owsley notes, though, quote, "with the loss of Claiborne's troops, only the 3rd Regiment remained available, and its activity was greatly restricted by General Flournoy's lack of cooperation." This would not prove to be the only delay in completing a military action that had originally been envisioned as a 2 or 3 month affair. The force from Georgia took a while to get organized and work out logistical issues with ensuring an adequate supply line for an active force of around 1,500, but would finally set out in mid-November 1813. Though they were able to achieve a key victory at the Battle of Ottossie on November 29th near modern-day Shorter, Alabama, the Georgians were forced to turn back due to supply issues. This battle left the native forces in a bad place. As noted by Owsley, quote, "after the defeat at Ottossie, the Red Sticks found their powder supply completely exhausted. This shortage, combined with the defeat, had caused some of the hostiles to flee into the swamps with their families or make their way to Pensacola, where they hoped to find safety among the Spaniards." There was absolutely no delay, however, in General Andrew Jackson's command. During this time, Jackson would rely on his trusted subordinate, General John Coffey, who would lead the 1st Tennessee forces into Muskogee territory. Unfortunately for his command, Coffey would quickly experience a condition that would come to plague Jackson's army: food shortages. As noted by Owsley, quote, "the contractors could find little or no flour, and suitable corn was very scarce in Tennessee. The contractors would have needed several months' advance warning to supply adequately an army as large as General Jackson's." Still, they pressed on, and Jackson sent Coffey's force, quote, "to destroy the Black Warrior towns just south of the Tennessee River." Now, this mission in October 1813 would be accomplished with no issue, and indeed, the campaign ended because, quote, "Coffey ran out of Creek settlements to plunder and burn, and his army was fast running out of food." The problem, however, as explained by Owsley, is that, quote, "the fact that he, Coffey, attacked and destroyed these villages with no opposition caused both Coffey and Jackson to believe that the hostile Creeks would not fight. Encouraged by this weakness, Jackson was more willing than ever to take the offensive. Despite his eagerness, however, the constant shortage of supplies delayed his move for many weeks. Under orders from Jackson, Coffey launched a successful attack against the native village of Tallahatchie on November 3rd, and then, on November 9th, Jackson himself led a force against a hostile native force besieging friendly Muskogee in the fortified village of Talladega. Though both were victories for American forces, supply issues kept them from being followed up upon, and again from Owsley, quote, "had Jackson been able to spend several days in searching for the Indians, it is probable that Talladega would have been decisive in breaking the morale of the hostiles." Meanwhile, Jackson had to deal with the issue of General John Cock. Though Jackson was the commanding general of the Tennessee State Militia, Cock was the commander of the Eastern Militia Division. Jackson had ordered a force under Cock's division to support his established headquarters at Fort Strother as he marched his force to Talladega. But Cock gave this force conflicting orders, and thus Jackson had to turn back from the victory at Talladega to reinforce Fort Strother. As if that wasn't enough, Koch refused to join forces with Jackson immediately, as the commanding general had requested. Instead, he, quote, moved his army against the Hillabee towns, which was a subgroup of Muskogee. Joined with Cherokee forces, a detachment of American militia troops in November attacked and destroyed a number of Hillabee settlements. Unfortunately, unbeknownst to Koch, Jackson had been negotiating with the Hillabee and, quote, agreed on November 17th to make peace with the Hillabees if they would deliver the instigators of the war and restore all property which they had taken from the whites. With the attack on their villages, however, as explained by Owsley, quote, the Hillabees, thinking themselves betrayed, determined thereafter to fight to the death. This tribe was indeed one of the last of the Creek groups to make peace with the Americans. Before he could deal with Koch, Jackson had to address a more immediate problem on his hands. When he returned back to Fort Strother, Jackson found that no new supplies had shown up, and thus, there was no food left. The troops on hand were pleading with the general, quote, to allow them to return to the frontier so that they could get food and replenish their supplies. Luckily, contractors sent on some small shipments of supplies, which prevented a full-on mutiny, but it was still a powder keg of a situation. On multiple occasions, Jackson had to use one part of his force to keep another group of the troops under his command from marching out of the fort to head home. Finally, the general put forward a proposition to his field officers and captains to bring back to their brigades for their consideration. If supplies didn't arrive within 2 days, quote, the whole army would march to Fort Deposit, a fortified position that Jackson had established as a supply depot. One brigade of volunteers opted to leave at once, but the rest remained. 2 days later, when no supplies arrived, Jackson made preparations to march his army out. With only 109 volunteers remaining at Fort Strother, Jackson led the march on November 18, 1813. However, quote, before the troops had gone more than 12 miles, they met a supply column herd of beeves and 9 wagons of flour. After the troops enjoyed a meal, Jackson gave orders for a small force, quote, to escort the sick and wounded back to Fort Deposit, and everyone else was ordered back to Fort Strother. The next crisis came when his volunteers started to complain that their one-year enlistments were coming to an end and that they should be ordered back home to be discharged. Despite Jackson's work to convince them to remain, on December 10th, he was forced to watch a majority of his force march out of the fort, bound for Tennessee. This left him with less than 1,000 militia troops. Thankfully, he soon received news that General Koch was finally heading his way with 1,450 soldiers under his command. Unfortunately, as soon as they arrived, Jackson learned that their terms of service were nearly over as well. Thus, he directed Koch, quote, to take his men home and to raise a new force of at least 1,500 men as quickly as he could. With only 400 troops under his command at this point, Jackson was forced to release yet another group of militia forces who were at the end of their enlistment. When it came down to it, Jackson only had at his disposal General Coffey's company of mostly officers, quote, who were willing to remain in Creek territory. At this point, at the end of 1813, General Jackson had 130 men remaining to defend Fort Strother. It is at this low ebb that we will leave General Jackson, for our time together is drawing to a close. Thanks so much again to Jackson Van Uden for providing the intro quote for this episode, and be sure to check out the History with Jackson podcast once you get done with this episode. Special thanks also to Chris Chevier, Podcast Pal, for his audio editing work on this episode. If you'd like to enlist Christian services for your podcast, check out his website at yourpodcastpal.com. Special thanks also to the folks at the Colonial Music Institute at George Washington's Mount Vernon, who graciously allowed us the use of clips from Hull's Victory as performed by David and Ginger Hildebrand for our intro and outro music. You can find out more about the great work that the Colonial Music Institute is doing to research and share information about early American music and dance by going to mountvernon.org and typing in Colonial Music Institute in the search field. Links to the websites for all of these folks, as well as sources used for this episode, past episodes of the podcast, links to more information about all of the U.S. presidents, and much more can be found at the website, which is presidenciespodcast.com. There, you can also learn the various ways that you can help support my work with the Presidencies Podcast, including but not limited to leaving a rating and review, filling some of the requests for books on my wish list for research for future episodes, and or becoming a patron of the podcast at patreon.com/presidencies. As Presidency celebrates its 7th anniversary since its launch, I cannot begin to tell you how invaluable the support that listeners have given has been to keeping this project going. A special thanks to all of our patrons, Matthew C., Jeremy, Michelle G., Ike, Joshua, Matthew N., Terrell, Eric, Howard, Michael, Michelle, and Scott. I cannot thank you enough for your generosity and continued support of this podcast in helping me to offset the cost of equipment, hosting fees, and research materials. If you'd like to reach out to me, please feel free to send me an email at presidenciespodcast@gmail.com. I'm also available on social media if you don't follow me on there already. I'm on Mastodon, Post, Blue Sky, and Facebook as Presidencies, on the platform formerly known as Twitter at Presidencies89, and on Instagram and Threads at Presidencies Podcast, all one word. Last, but certainly not least, I'd like to thank all of you for listening. Until next time, stay safe and healthy, be kind to one another, and take care, dear friends.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of the new Medal of Honor podcast from Evergreen Podcasts, brought to you in partnership with the National Medal of Honor Museum. In each 3-minute episode, we'll learn about a different service member who distinguished him or herself through an act of valor. We'll include stories from the Civil War to Iraq and Afghanistan, and from all branches of the military. We'll talk about service members who were overlooked for the medal at first due to their race or religion, and about those who were celebrated at the time. We'll hear stories of soldiers like Audie Murphy, future Hollywood star who mounted a burning tank to hold off German infantry in World War II. And people like Dr. Mary Edwards Walker, a Civil War Army doctor and the only woman to receive the Medal of Honor so far. Learn about these heroes and more wherever you get your podcasts.